The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
North Korea tensions are building. Jobs report came out well below estimates and GDP hits 3%. Our guest today, Vitaly Katsanelson from The Contrarian Edge. All this and much more on episode number 524 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome aboard. Andrew Horowitz here. I'm the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. It is, of course, the beginning of September. Labor Day is just around the corner. Tomorrow, as a matter of fact. Hope you're having a wonderful and relaxing end of summer break over this weekend. I just left the sandbar down in Miami. Man, there's a lot going on down there. I got to tell you something. They got boats coming around on the sandbar. First of all, it's wall-to-wall boats. I mean, you got boats with speakers like that you don't see in houses, blasting all sorts of music. And then they have all these small boats making deliveries from the various vendors that actually park their boats, you know, like ceviche, and they have tacos, they have hot dogs. They come around on the boats and they make deliveries. They have clams on the half shell that they're serving. Really cool experience down in Miami. Water was, you know, nice and warm, and it was kind of a fun day because the ocean was nice and calm. I was able to take the boat right down the coast off of Fort Lauderdale, shoot down in Miami into Hulliver area, and there's a really nice sandbar down there. But it was busy. It was packed. It was fun. But anyway, hopefully you're having a great time, and you have some opportunity to spend just a few moments with us talking about markets. We did notice that last week there was quite a bit of, I guess it was really interesting because the big employment report came out on Friday. Of course, the first Friday of the month is always the employment report. And I'm skipping ahead of some of the other reports that came out for a second because it was interesting. We had a really good week of economic reports from GDP that finally hit 3%. We saw consumer confidence hit 122. That was on Tuesday. We saw the ADP come out with 237 new jobs added in the private sector versus about 190 expectations. And then we get an economic report on employment that shows us that the unemployment rate ticked up slightly from 4.3% to 4.4%. Not bad. But expectations were pretty high going into this report because we thought that, well, the ADP report was pretty solid. What's going on there? It's probably going to be good at the end of the week. But in fact, we saw 156,000 jobs were added versus 190. Now, I think I mentioned last week that we knew that August has some very strange statistical anomalies that go along. And I don't really know all of the reasons why it is, but there are some things that happen in August, a lot of revisions that go on. And it's probably due to the part-time nature of summer, the people that are working throughout the summer, then going back to either school or going back to their normal workforce, or possibly people laying off in the area of, let's call it the end of July into August, you know, beefing up their staff. And then all of a sudden, you know, things slow down. We know a lot of people go on vacation in August, and maybe that was the reason why. But whatever the reason is, I'm not really terribly worried at this point from an economic standpoint, because when you look at all the other numbers, things look pretty good. In fact, I read a really interesting report last week on the PMIs, the manufacturing numbers around the world. And we saw some of the fastest growth in manufacturing numbers over the last couple of months than have been for years. And that's good. Now, the only thing that I'll tell you that had me scratching my head on that was, while we are seeing that there are really good manufacturing numbers on a global basis, we're still seeing consumer spending down. Confidence is up. This is something we've seen for a while, though. Confidence is up. Spending is down, or at least not really picking up dramatically. Wages are stagnant. So again, it's back to this odd disinflationary or non-inflationary environment that we're seeing. So anyway, that's something of interest, I thought, that was out there. And markets reacted pretty well, generally speaking, for all of the things that happened. Remember something, we saw the missile launch over Japan by North Korea last week, and that really caused an initial reaction to the downside on futures and popped right back up, actually. By the end of the day, in the normal market hours after that, the U.S. markets were green again. I'm not exactly sure that's going to happen this time that we saw that North Korea has tested and successfully tested what they're calling a hydrogen bomb that also is capable of being, quote, miniaturized and put into a intercontinental ballistic missile. And now they're testing this and they're really speeding up their testing and their antagonistic military nonsense. Now, this is freaking out everybody. All the politicians are bugging out. You know, they talked about they're going to really have to have more sanctions and they're going to have to do some more talking. I mean, you know how parents, you ever see this where parents say, Johnny, don't do that. Johnny, I'm going to count to three. Johnny, stop doing that. One, Johnny, two, three, and then they start four, five. Like, wait. Weren't you supposed to count to three and then the punishment was supposed to take place? You go to four and five and six. I've seen people count to like 10. And then they don't do anything. And what do you think Johnny does? Johnny's like, well, I know that they're just going to keep counting. They look like idiots. I'm just going to keep doing what I want to do. This is kind of what's going on with the world ex North Korea. Japan's saying, oh, we're going to have to do sanctions. Oh, we say this is, you know, in the strongest possible sense, we are against this and say this is, you know, a crime against humanity, what you're doing, and we're not going to put up with this. United States, you know, we hear the fire and fury. We hear all these discussions from Mattis and the generals and the various European leaders, you know, oh, we're not going to stand for this. We're going to have sanctions. We're going to have a resolution. This is like we're up to like Johnny, up to the count of like five or six at this point. And North Korea is Johnny saying, well, they're not going to do anything. So we'll continue doing what we're doing. Now, I'm not saying we should do anything significant like go to war or anything like that. But I just don't think that the right thing either is to have, empty threats. That's not working. We'll have to see how markets react to this time, because now we're getting serious. Now we have successful testing of a bomb. We have them not caring that they're flying missiles over another country's sovereign airspace. So a lot going on in the area of the Pacific Rim and the Pacific region that's really going to put, I think, a big concern to markets moving ahead. And of course, you know, we have all the news that is going on with regard to Texas. And if you saw what happened with oil and gas prices, oil dropped down and kind of stabilized initially before the hurricane. It popped up, then it came down significantly. And we saw gas prices up, I guess they're up about 12 or 13% because many of the refineries are offline. And we're seeing that the pipelines were closed. That's starting to turn around as the waters are receding. We're seeing that more refineries are giving us dates when they're going to be coming back. We're seeing the pipeline is cleared and it's able to pump fuel. But probably what we're going to see is an increase in the price of gas at the pump, which should, I would think, put a little bit of damper on consumer spending, even though there's a general damper to begin with. So we're going to have to keep our eyes on that whole situation with what's going on there. Now, I don't know what's going to happen in terms of the price of oil with some of this geopolitical issues that go on, because we are seeing that every time we're seeing a geopolitical issue, the dollar comes in a bit and it weakens. And already we're seeing, even though futures are open, markets are closed in the U.S. for Labor Day, we're seeing that there was a significant drop to the dollar on the news of this nuclear or hydrogen bomb testing within North Korea over the weekend. And with the dollar moving and with all that's been happening recently, one of the things that really stood out to me over the last week or so was the fact that gold has been plowing higher. Bitcoin hit 5,000, then dropped back down. So the alternative currencies were getting a lot of movement, and there was a lot of people looking for this. There was a good amount of stories that I saw saying, well, people aren't buying gold as an alternative asset right now for protection, for safety. They're buying cryptocurrencies. And as a matter of fact, I mentioned last week that we were going to have on this cryptocurrency expert. He told me he couldn't do it. Something came up for this week, and he's going to do it next week. So hopefully we're going to get that going. But gold has been popping. It's over 1,300 and starting to move in the right direction. I think that is good. We actually, had a gold position for a while. I'm thinking that right now it may be time to get back towards that. And of course, the gold miners have been doing pretty well. This is an interesting change of direction. Gold has been in a longer term downtrend and really hasn't been working very well, even with the dollar down 10% this year to date. But I do wonder if now, with the political tensions rising, if gold is going to be something that we want to look at a little bit more, seriously and intently. And the gold miners may be something you could look at too. Anyway, just a few things. And again, it's a holiday weekend, so I wanted to make sure we get a few things out there in terms of what's going on the economics, and then get to our guest, because our guest is a great guest. We've had him on before. If you've ever read his work, brilliant writer, great investor on the side of, he works on the side of, I was called value investing. So I think that he's going to be able to bring us some very interesting stuff as he's done in the past. Let's get right to him. And our guest today is Vitaly Katsanelson. He's been on before. He writes, he's a brilliant writer, by the way. He writes something called The Contrarian Edge. His professional career probably can be described as investing and educating, writing. And he loves it, actually. I know that about him. He's a chief investment officer at Investment Management Associates, which is a value-oriented investment firm based in Colorado. Vitaly, nice to have you back.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
So I know, one of the things I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, because I feel a major deja vu going on here. Back in the mid-90s, there was this massive just stampede towards value investing. As a matter of fact, growth investing was like not only shunned, it was like, no, I don't want that stuff. And then all of a sudden, back in the late 90s into the beginning of 2000, there was a mad rush into growth stocks. Everybody looking at value saying, hell, I don't want that crap. And I know you do primarily, you're a value investor. So first, I want you to start off with explaining to everybody the difference between value and growth. And if you're seeing the same thing kind of now with the value growth concept in investing.
Okay. So let's talk about value investing. The way I look at value investing is a little bit differently than what you may think. What normal value investor is. To me, value investing is a philosophy. It's almost like a religion, and it's not necessarily, if you just look at value investing, oh, this is a guy who buys stocks at 0x at 5x earnings, or buys whatever else is about to go out of business for 3x earnings. That's not what value investing is. Value investing is a philosophy that has a certain governing principles, like I call them commandments. Mm-hmm. And those commandments would be basically we treat stocks not as pieces of paper, but as a business. So when I analyze a company, I'm basically making an assumption that, like, I would analyze it the same way as if I was buying the whole company, not just a few thousand shares. That's number one. Number two, Mr. Market is there to serve us. It's not, not the other way around. In other words, stock market will be going up and down. Stock prices will go up and down. To us, it's actually a benefit, because we will take advantage when the market is depressed and some of our stocks get tremendously mispriced. And when market is exuberant, stocks are going up and become fully valued, we'll sell them. But market does not tell us what things are worse. That's up to us. Right. It's really my job.
So let me just stop you there for say one point here. What you're saying is it's a market of stocks, not a stock market per se, in your eyes, and that you're looking at each individual position rather than necessarily worrying about the market. But the market is important, but you're really breaking it down to, okay, do I like this name, this position, this stock versus, oh, what's the stock market doing?
I think that's right. No, that's right. But I think there is one even a finer point. Market expresses an opinion on what my stock is, how my stock is priced today, but that's not a final judgment. And I think that's very important. So when I come to work and I see my stocks are down 10%, I don't I may actually celebrate because I may buy more of them. But if I know what they're worth, and if the value of the business hasn't declined, but the market priced them lower, that actually may end up being a good thing. And I think that's what sets value investors a little bit different from other type of investors.
So I know that if I remember this correctly, I may not be remembering this correctly, but the last time you were on, I think we had a little bit of a discussion, and I was on the opposite side, and I probably was a lot shorter term in thinking than you were on this, on HP. I think you really like that company. I think. Am I correct in this?
God, well, this was like maybe 5 or 6 years ago.
Well, okay. Years. But that played out pretty well for you, right?
Well, yes, but at first you were probably right in the shorter term. So I don't remember when it was, but at first when we bought it, it declined.
Right.
And as it declined, we kept buying more, and it actually ended up declining a lot more than I thought it would rationally could, but it's ended up working out just fine. But at the Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, but that's the difference between, let's say, a growth investor and a momentum player and a value investor. Momentum players may be buying down a little bit, but once this thing cracks, they're done. Once that whole aura of potential intermediate term movement is over, they're done. Value investors, you're really trying to understand this company could be worth a lot more than it is. And what the market is giving it credit for sometime down the road, and you're willing to wait out until such a time. And I think that there's a place for that. That's not necessarily, I'll be honest with you, I don't know if that's necessarily what I can do as a incomplete part of my portfolio. Somewhere in between. I like to bob and weave. I like to go both sides. I like to have my feet in both sides of the situation. But I wanted to get to the whole idea in terms of value. I've seen this play out before in a much different circumstance. And I want to talk about the retail in relation to your article that you published. By the way, you have a little accent. Are you aware of this?
No.
Oh, I have the accent. Maybe I have the accent. But what's fascinating? You're like the Beatles. When you write, you don't have an accent when you write.
And the funny part, I don't even think it was the accent.
Right, exactly. No, I'm kidding. So listen, you wrote a piece called "It's Not Just Amazon's Fault." Obviously, talking about the whole change in character of consumption, as well as what's going on with retail. Now, I remember very clearly that retail fell off a cliff. Just generally speaking, retail in general and spending too, by the way, fell off a cliff back in whatever called 2008 or so. I mean, the retail stocks were beaten up pretty badly. It was really, really ugly, and you're wondering who's going to stay here. But that was in a time that was much different. In that time, it was a circumstance that obviously we were in not only a recession, close to a depression, but now we have consumers still spending and actually have consumer confidence high. However, we're seeing a lot of the similar kinds of damage to many of these retail names. And let's talk about what's going on. Tell me about it.
Yeah. So as a value investor, right, whenever something declines as much as retail stocks have, I get attracted to that. Not to buy them necessarily, but to look at them to see if these companies are undervalued. And when we look at retail, the first thing, and you see stock prices decline, the first thing that comes to your mind, we should blame Amazon because it's the kind of Amazon is destroying them. Uh-huh. But as I took a closer look, I found that the story is so much more complex than just Amazon. So just think about it. Our retail sales in the United States is about $5.5 trillion. Mm. Our online sales are about 8.5% of that. which is, you know, so that's, that number 10 years ago was maybe 2 or 3%. Now online sales are 8.5% of that. And Amazon maybe is only 1.5% of total retail sales. Okay, this, you know, Amazon sales are roughly about $100-150 billion. That's about 1-1.5% of, you know, total retail sales. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is that if you look at our spending 10 years ago we did, you know, iPhone just came out. We didn't really have smartphones yet, right?
Right.
Nokia was the king of dumb phones. And I guesstimate kind of Nokia's sales in the US were maybe $10 billion. Like not just Nokia's, the kind of the dumb sales in the US were about $10 billion. Mm-hmm. Fast forward to today, my guesstimate that we spent close to $200 billion on the smartphones and kind of all accessories that come with, you know, the smartphones. And then also if you look at our wireless bill, I did some digging around. I find that our bill probably went up by about $100 billion over the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. It's not just because the price is, you know, higher, but more importantly, because you have, now you probably have dogs that have smartphones, right?
Yeah, well, mine does.
So just think about it. In the context of this, you basically have $300 billion that was redirected from consumer spending on clothes or shoes or whatever, and now that money is going to gadgets and wireless bill. That is a much greater number than Amazon sales, which are only $150 billion, let's say, on the high end. So that in itself, you know, our discretionary income hasn't really changed, you know, hasn't gone up much over the last 10 years. But I think our spending habits and our spending interests have changed. So that would be my point number one.
Now, by the way, that's interesting because let me just say something. On a personal note, I never really thought about this. You know, I remember way back when I was kind of like needing a pick me up of some sort. You know, I'm a Jewish guy, so what you first thing you do is you go get some food. You know, you're not feeling right. What are you gonna do? All right, feed me. The second thing I would do is let me go buy something for myself. Uh-huh. You know, let me go out there and buy, I don't know, whatever it is, a piece of clothing, a piece of electronics equipment. You know, whatever it was. And then these days, though, so. First, of course, food is the first thing. But after that, I mean, it's like, all right, let me go watch a video on YouTube or let me go kind of play around on Twitter, see what somebody's doing on Facebook. I mean, just I'm saying it's a much different encounter than I had. So maybe you're right that some of the social media concept and the opportunity to have technology at my fingertips as well as entertainment at my fingertips is a substitute for maybe somebody's needs or desires that they shopped for in the past, just as a side note.
So what you're basically saying that Twitter is your comfort food.
Yeah, exactly. It gets me angry and it gets me happy at the same time. Right?
You're right. I mean, our habits have changed. Our interests and our spending issues have changed dramatically. But Andrew, it gets worse. Just think about, remember there was a saying, you can never bet against the U.S. consumer because right. U.S. consumer kept spending and spending. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. retail footprint, which is basically built in the 90s and 2000s, was built for the consumer that doesn't exist anymore. The consumer used to borrow money against the houses and keep going to, you know, whatever, to, you know, to shopping malls. They don't do this anymore. Consumer is deleveraging. But, you know, after the Great Recession, the consumer started to deleverage. And because of that, you have a retail footprint that has been basically created for a consumer that is, you know, still borrowing money and, you know, and buying stuff on credit cards. So here's the very important point. U.S. is over retailed. We have about 4 to 5 times retail stores per, you know, the retail square foot per, you know, per capita than, you know, than people in Europe, or, you know, basically people in Europe.
Right.
So we basically have too many retail stores, and that's something a lot of retailers still, you know, still dealing with, because they, you know, a lot of them are, this, so they, until recently, they were still kept opening new stores. And that's, by the way, we haven't even talked about online sales, right? But even beside that, we have too many stores, you know, even before it came to online. And the last point I want to make is this. 10, 20 years ago, the companies were very kind to their employees, and they said, on Fridays, you can come and wear jeans, right? You mm-hmm. have casual Fridays. Well, today, every day is casual. So suddenly we don't really care as much, you know, we don't have to spend as much time as money on the clothes. And so we don't, you know, and so that has changed, you know, how much, you know, basically our behavior as well. So you combine all this and you basically say it's not just Amazon that's, you know, driving retail sales down. It's really, we have changed and retailers haven't.
But at the same time, some of the retail is, the prices have gone up dramatically. I can tell you something without giving away my total secrets here. I used to buy like Hanes underwear. It was like $10 for like five underwears. Now I buy Tommy John's at like $34-$40 a piece.
You probably have a little bit more money now than you have than when you were spending, you know, the $10 for the underwear.
I suppose, but it still seems like a little bit ridiculous to pay $35 for a pair of underwear. But I guess it's not a Tommy John commercial. I must say they're very comfortable. But the thing is, and if, by the way, if you haven't tried Tommy John's, can I just say something seriously? Do yourself a favor and get yourself one. Just go buy one pair of Tommy John's. It's life-changing, seriously. But how is this going to play out now? Is this going to be like what happened with Starbucks when Starbucks was, you remember when Starbucks was having all sorts of problems? They built all these properties across the street from each other and things like that. They were just too much of it. And then they just said, we're closing down all these stores. We're seeing some of that happen already, but there's also, I think, there are pockets of places that do well, but every time I go to a mall, there's nobody in it. I don't go very often, but there's nobody there. We've also changed to these outdoor mall things, you know. We have the mega stores here. You don't see these mega stores in a lot of other countries, you know, these gigantic Walmarts everywhere. So we're over retail, but how is this going to change?
Well, I think we're going to go through painful adjustment where retail is going to reset to new square footage. So you're probably going to have a lot of store closed and probably A malls will be fine. And maybe some B malls will be fine, but C malls will go out of business for the most part. So
the same thing with stores, I assume. I mean, because, you know, look at the C, like the JCPenney, the Sears. I mean, these things are hanging on with a thread.
Yeah, but also in all fairness, those are kind of became irrelevant. Just they were mismanaged and became irrelevant as well. So in addition to everything else, they have their own problems. But I think what's going to happen, like let's say Foot Locker, right?
Yeah.
Which is probably one of the best run kind of fashion shoes retailers out there. You know, they just have too many stores. So what's going to happen, they're going to go through a painful time where they're going to close, I don't know, 10, 20% of their stores. And then, you know, their earnings will decline. They will take charges. They have to cancel leases, et cetera. But then after that, they'll be fine.
Well, will they be fine? But will they be fine? Because now if they close stores, people won't be able to find them as easily and they'll just go online and buy it because what they're selling is the same thing you could buy online. Nike sells direct. You could buy them on Amazon. You could buy them Finish Line and ShoeBuy.com, all these different names, you know, or you could buy all this stuff online. So why do I even want to go to the store? If in fact, here's the big issue. If there is free returns, no free returns, I get it, right? You know, I can't return. Yeah. I got to buy the right size. But I buy like five pairs of shoes in all different sizes, figure out what fits and send the rest back.
So I think it's very easy to look at this kind of in binary terms. But I think we are not binary. So some goods like books, for instance, you don't need to go to the store to buy them, right? So that's kind of that would be on one spectrum. I would argue that shoes or clothes in general would be kind of on the opposite spectrum, where some people would choose to buy things online, and that's fine. A lot of people will still want to touch them and try different pairs of shoes. So I think 10 years from now, no question in my mind, larger percentage of shoes will be sold online than sold in stores today, that's sold today in general. But it's not going to be 100%. No, it's not going to be 100%.
Just wait until the app comes out that I can take a picture of my foot with the app and they will ship me a shoe that fits my foot.
If that happens, you just realize this. Our habits need to change.
I'm not arguing with you, but let me ask you this. Where do you find value here?
So I don't. I only own.
It's that bad, huh?
Well, because I think the pain is still ahead of us. And, you know, so we only have exposure to one retail concept, and it's outside of the United States, and it sells groceries. So it's not even, you know, it's a, so it's a, has its own uniqueness there. But we basically have, you know, any retail stock we owned a few years ago, we got out, luckily, because it just, it's too difficult. I think retail got to the point, at this point in time, is where the prices are still, for a lot of them, are not cheap enough. But, and so we just basically kind of, you know, standing on the sidelines and looking at something else right now.
And remember something about retail. That mm-hmm. if you see retail and it reminds you of how bad things got with the banking industry back into 2007 through 2009, there's one gigantic difference. The Fed isn't bailing out the retailers.
Well, that's true.
You know?
They can all go out of business. Yeah, that's very true.
What about Walmart? That's- just real quickly. What about Walmart? What about Target? Aside from, just putting aside the Amazon Whole Foods deal for a second here, do these have any value?
I think Walmart is priced as if it's going to be successful. You know, it's going to be as a, you know, it's priced, you know, 15, 17 times earnings, probably 17 times earnings. So that one is not cheap at all. And so most of all of Walmart's growth will come from online sales because they can't really open new stores in the United States. You know, they're probably going to shrink them. Target is a lot cheaper than Walmart. But I haven't figured it out yet. So
I gotcha.
Between the two, if you put gun to my head, I would buy Target. Yeah. Just because I think they're similar quality, but Target is a lot cheaper. So
we'll have to see how this all plays out. I mean, Amazon put a major, you know, raised the bar in terms of saying, you know what, we're going to reduce down the cost here on Whole Foods. By the way, I went to Whole Foods just yesterday mm-hmm. to say, and I haven't been to Whole Foods forever, and I haven't been because it scares the hell out of me going in there. The pricing, mm-hmm. and all, right? So I went in just yesterday. Like, I'm going to buy this place, and I hear the prices are lower and all that. So I got like a dinner and a half. We'll call it a dinner and a half. Like I actually bought some cheese. I bought some olives. I bought a nice bottle of wine for the wife and I to have last night. And then I bought some dinner, like some of that pre-made stuff, and I bought some other things. It was like $125. I'm like, where's the savings here?
Yeah, and this is coming from a guy who is spending $30 in underwear.
Exactly. So, so you understand what I'm talking about here, right?
I think in investing, it's very important to a lot of times say when you know, I don't know, saying I, this is too difficult to move on. And in my mind, when I look at retail, I don't have an insight.
Right.
Like I don't. So a lot of I look at them and say, I have no insight. I move on. Like going back to our HP conversation from years ago, I had an insight because I could not kill the company.
Yeah.
We would model it. We would assume lower margins, lower sales, and we still could not kill the company. With a lot of these retail, you know, concepts, if they stopped existing, nobody would care.
Right. Exactly. So let me ask you something. Let's kind of skip ahead here now. You have another piece that you wrote, another really good piece called Finding High Quality Companies Today. And take me through a little bit about your process of how you actually start and you kind of figure out, okay, I want to find a company. What do you do?
Okay. So let me kind of give you a framework. Our framework basically rests in three pillars: quality, valuation, and growth. Mm-hmm. Until maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago, quality was not an absolute pillar. And let me explain what I mean. So I would look at a company and let's say it was kind of a low quality company, but the stock was very cheap. I would say, okay, you know, it's not a high quality company, but it's a very cheap stock. And I'm going to buy it. Okay. A couple of years ago, or 2 years ago, I realized that quality should be an absolute. Yeah. Meaning that when I analyze a company and it doesn't pass my quality screen, I stop. Just, it doesn't matter how cheap it is. It becomes irrelevant to me. And the reason for that, because, and let's talk about what quality is.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. That's a good point, because I'd like to know what that is.
Yeah, so there's many definitions. The simplest one is this. This is plagiarizing Warren Buffett. If the stock market was closed for 10 years, and so you can sell it, would you be comfortable owning this company? So just think about it. So suddenly when you phrase it this way, you start looking at the company differently. But from a practical perspective, how we arrive to this, we break up our quality analysis into three buckets. We look at company's business, and this would be, you know, and the most important question there would be, does it have a sustainable competitive advantage? And then we have some other ones, you know, does it have high recurrence of revenues? Does it have high return on capital? This kind of stuff. So that would be business. Then the second question, the second bucket would be balance sheet. Does company have a great balance sheet or not? And it's, you know, so that would be second. And third, management. And when we analyze management, we analyze them on two dimensions there: how well they run business, how well they allocate capital. So put it all together and you have a kind of the ingredients that go into a quality company. Okay. So I find that in today's environment, macroeconomic environment, quality is paramount. Mm-hmm. And this is why it should not be compromising. And the reason for that, because we are kind of the global economy is kind of freaky. It's all over leveraged and central banks play a very large role. And things could change very, very fast. And in the global economy. And I want to want companies that if things go bad, these companies will be able to survive. Companies that have a lot, today nobody cares about this because we have easy money. Mm-hmm. My God, God forbid we have deflation or we have very high inflation, quality companies will be fine. Weak players, you know, will basically the ones that you know do fine today will be out of business. So when clients come to us, I tell them, you know, that I, you know, my job, and I'm sure you do the same thing, is, you know, number one is to preserve capital. If you own high quality companies and you buy them cheap, you know, combination of these two, then you'll be fine no matter what market throws at you. Not the market per se, but the economy throws at you. And this is why I think in today's environment, quality being an absolute standard is paramount.
I mean, it's also important. I mean, with the markets at these levels, with the amount of time they've had to clean up their balance sheet, with the amount of cheapness in terms of capital acquisition, and with the ability for or with the incredible amount of change and transparency of corporate reports, there's no reason not to to invest in a high quality company if you're doing it for the long haul, right?
Yes, except they also have to be undervalued.
They have to be what?
They also have to be undervalued.
I got you.
Okay, because you can always find high quality companies. They're just going to be expensive. So finding both is very difficult. And I think what happened to a lot of value investors, and I put myself into that bucket as well for a short period of time, when I could not find high quality companies to buy, you know, they were undervalued, I shifted to the lower side of the quality curve just because I couldn't buy cheap stocks. Mm. And I think that's dangerous. So I, you know, we made a shift in our strategy about 2 years ago because I realized, you know, if I don't do this at some point, I'm going to pay a very dear price.
Yeah. But are you finding, I mean, I know there was a time when you had a lot of extra cash in the portfolio and I respect that because you couldn't find the quality and that, I mean, you're finding the same can't find the value. Yeah. Are you finding that to be the same circumstance today? Now, remember, people that are listening, I want to make sure you're clear about something. There's a difference between investing for the long haul and using certain criteria as Vitaly uses here and, let's say, trading or momentum investing. There's a totally different situation here. It's different also from, hey, I know that company. I like that company. I want to buy that company. My brother-in-law works for that company. He said, buy that company, and I buy that company. We're talking about a well-researched, long-term way of buying stocks that will hopefully, you know, end up being the appropriate way for Vitaly and her circumstances to amass wealth. Everybody has their own thing. First of all, I have an absolute disdain for anybody that's pounding the desk one way or another per se and says the other guy is just full of shit. I mean, you know, everybody has their right to view however they want to view the markets and invest. And if they make money, it's fine. But you know what? Other people have other ideas. So where are you now in this? I mean, we look at the Case-Shiller PE ratio. It's kind of getting really toppy here, plus 30 something, right? Well over the 10-year average. There's a variety of other indicators. However, even with the threat of the potential for Korea having the ability, or no, let's say it this way, forget about the ability. They shot a rocket and it went over another country's airspace. That's like a no-no. Either our leaders are totally around the world are totally impotent and just can talk a good game, but not really do anything more, which is, I think there's some truth there. you know, we've seen this over and over again saying, oh, you know, Japan's saying if you do this, well, we're going to do that. And then it never happens.
Yeah.
But even with that, the markets pulled back a bit overnight and then ended up in the U.S. being higher by the end of the day. And we're seeing this time and time again that there seems to be an insatiable appetite to be in anything. And especially if it dips for 2 days, people just buy it back the next day. Are you in the circumstance now, though, you're having a more difficult time with all this kind of environment finding good, deep value stocks?
Yes. It's kind of funny. I'm sure you spend some time on Twitter. When we have a 2%, when market declines 2%, now we call it a correction now.
Yeah, it's, half a percent, I think, is people throwing themselves off buildings.
Yes. Well, I guess when the market is not up, that's already down there.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So it's kind of interesting. The way we manage portfolios, our new accounts will own different stocks than existing clients, right? Because I might have bought a stock 6 months ago and went up already where it's not quite a buy yet, but it's not, you know, it's not a sell either. Mm-hmm. So our new accounts today are only 30% invested. So they're 70% in cash. Our existing accounts have been with us for a while are probably 70% invested or maybe 65% invested and 30-35% in cash. And if I had to look through my portfolio without naming names, like especially new accounts, I would look just like a pharmaceutical fund. Like the value today I find in the market overall is, you know, if you're looking for quality that's undervalued, it's probably in the pharmaceutical sector or in the healthcare related sectors. Mm-hmm. That's probably the cheapest, you know, but outside of that, you may see ideas here and there, but this market, I wrote an article about this where I looked at this, you know, Case-Shiller index. I looked at a whole bunch of other, you know, kind of market indicators, market valuation indicators. And every single one of them basically says, the only time stocks were more expensive, that was 1999.
Yeah.
That was that. So I wrote a letter to clients and I said, okay, if I look at my watch list, and so what we do, we look at a company and say, okay, we think it's worth 100 for us to buy, we need to buy it at 70 or whatever. Okay. So there is a 30%, basically we need a 30% discount. Okay. So I look at the companies on the watch list. On the average, they have to decline 30-40% for me to start buying my watch list, if I wanted to buy the whole list.
Yeah.
And then, so the market is extremely expensive and it's very difficult to buy, to find high quality companies that are undervalued. So therefore we default to not to time the market, but we just basically say, if we can, we're not going to compromise. So we can find high quality that's undervalued. We're going to have cash.
I mean, that makes sense. I mean, the only problem comes if we have an elongated, I've been through this game long enough, many, many years. Okay. I go back to the late 80s and I've seen where clients start pushing around and they get a little concerned about that. And they get cranky. And by the way, that always signals the time when things are getting way too hot. Mm-hmm. If you have a normal allocation to what you agreed with the client, and then they start getting like really crazy about, oh my God, I want to be in, Netscape, or I remember those days. I was like, oh, this is getting bad. Whether or not it was value or not, whether or not it was a reasonable price or not. But once they start trying to hit for the Bitcoins, then I'm starting to get, where are we going with this? And I feel like we're getting closer to that, but I just don't also know at the same time with the fact that the U.S. economy is pretty much doing fine, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. International markets, plenty of liquidity out there, plenty of stimulus out there, doing just fine. A couple of little, headwinds here and there, which we have Korea, some geopolitical tensions, now this oil issue. And, but now don't forget, this is how twisted this market is. We look at the hurricane and the damages in Texas as a good thing for stocks. Because of all the rebuilding, the builders should do well, the drywall companies will do well. Look at all the opportunities that are going to be there for the bottled water companies and the mattress companies and all this, some of the car companies that are like Carvana and a few others, popping. And it's just, that may be the case, by the way, But, you know, at the same time, there's some talk saying, oh, this is good for insurance companies. I'm thinking, oh, how does that, how do you twist that around?
Well, I think the insurance companies, basically, if the hurricane does not put them out of business, if they leave to, you know, if they don't have to raise capital, you know, then basically insurance price will go up, and past the losses next year, they're, you know, they're going to have a, you know, they'll be able to raise prices.
And then they get to say it was a one-time event. They get to say that too.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You know, but at the same time, you know, already we're seeing that, just as a side note here, we're seeing that, you know, the government was making some, having some press conference saying, you know, we're really proud of the fact that for all the people who were flooded, lost their homes, lost their businesses, lost their cars, now we have loans available for them. I'm thinking to myself, man, it used to be a dirty word. Now people are like, yeah, I want to wait, your house just blew down. Now you want to get into debt all over again?
Kind of crazy. No, it is. I think the you started this, you know, when you and I started talking today, you mentioned like value goes through cycles, right? And the market goes through cycles. And the value stocks have underperformed growth stocks over the last, I don't know, 5 or 7 years. That is probably the longest stretch in a history for whatever the, you know, I don't know how long they've been tracking value versus growth, but for as long as they've been tracking, that is the longest period of time that value underperformed growth.
Right.
And the reason for that is this, kind of coming back to what you were just saying. When, if you think of value as a kind of, as a, like, let's say 5-year bonds, and think of growth as a 30-year bonds, right?
Yeah.
The way those bonds behave at different interest rates is very different, right?
Yeah.
When rates go up, let's say 1%, hypothetically, the 5-year bonds will decline a little bit. 30-year bonds will decline a lot, right?
Right, yeah.
So, however, when rates go down to an insane level, like they have, you know, don't go down a lot, 5-year bond will go up a little bit, 30-year bond will skyrocket.
Right.
So my point is that over the last 8 years, interest rates declined so much that has benefited tremendously valuation of growth stocks. Because if you think about definition, growth stocks, a lot larger portion of their earnings lies far in the future. So if as you discounted with lower rate, right?
Yeah.
Those earnings become more valuable in today's dollars. Okay.
Right.
Okay. Where value stocks, again, this is oversimplification, they're not growing as fast by definition. Therefore, a larger portion of their earnings lies in present years, and therefore they're not as, you know, they don't benefit as much when rates go down.
Right.
At some point that's going to reverse.
Yep. Hopefully soon. Hopefully it's going to happen soon. I would like to have a little bit more normality because I'll tell you though, you know what's interesting? So we have a growth screen. And our growth screen consists of some of the things you talk about, but consistency, it's more of a consistency of earnings growth, consistency of revenue growth, high ROE, margin expansion, a whole bunch of other things that are more on the growth side. You know what's interesting? We're at the top amount of securities that have come through that screen than we've seen probably in the last year and a half. So the quality has gone up dramatically on the growth side. At least so they're making us think.
No, I think actually I would disagree with you. And let me explain what I mean by this.
Okay.
Like, if you put quality in these terms, right? Because what you're saying, basically, number of years that the company were able to increase sales, you know, has gone up, right? And that's therefore, number of companies that, you know, that achieved that has increased.
Right.
The problem is, just because they have done this for the last 5 years does not mean they will be able to do this.
Oh, we don't know. I don't know what's going to happen next month.
No, exactly. But my point is, it's very easy to draw straight lines through this kind of, you know, sales growth, because a lot of times, and we saw this with U.S. consumer when it came to retail sales, for instance, a lot of times they're borrowing sales from the future. I mean, just look at car sales. I mean, car sales were going up for a long time until they stopped. Yeah, you know, because guess what, we already extended loans 8 years out. You know, everybody who wanted to have a car already has a car, and suddenly now sales start to decline again. All I'm saying is, if this is your definition of quality, I would just be careful with that because
This is earnings growth quarter over quarter over the last several years. By the way, we run this quarterly and swap stuff out. So therefore, if somebody starts changing, we'll have much fewer names.
Sure.
You know, we have revenue growth quarter over quarter. We have, margin expansion. This is all consistently over the last, let's say, 2 or 3 years, quarter over quarter, you know, back. Each one of them has to line up. Now, I agree with you, by the way, that at the end of the day, that may come to a crashing halt. And you got to be careful with that. And that's why we run it on a regular basis to see what's going on. But I just thought it was interesting that we saw a lot more names come through than we've been seeing. You know?
Which is, by the way, kind of consistent with the expansion, you know, when the economy is expanded, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's,
when you have a recession, that will change dramatically.
Yes, it would.
Yeah. But there is actually another interesting point. Think about what happened in the last 8 years. The economy has grown because stock market went up. A lot of it has, right? Because stock market went up. Okay. But it also worked the other way. So when you talk about, you know, what's going to cause next recession, let me give you kind of an outside-the-box kind of thinking. If the stock market declines more than 2%, and I'm being facetious when I say that, if the stock market declines and it's, you know, and stays there for a while, that in itself could cause a recession.
That's why the Fed is so damn straight and hell-bent on keeping this up. And that's why there is other – I'm not going to get into a whole conspiracy thing here and all that, but there is something else going on that every time the market drops for 2 days, it comes right back. Somebody doesn't want this thing closing in the red. And you know what? We're coming into when you come into the end of a week, the end of a month, how there's end of a quarter, how there's this mad dash to try to push the market back up to get in the green. There must be some kind of algos also out there that are freaking out if it goes red under the close.
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but
it's possible.
I don't know.
Possible.
That's kind of a zero hedge kind of a.
Yeah, all right. I hear it. Anyway, Vitaly Katsanelson, Contrarian Edge. Where can they get your information? Well, we're going to put the information on the site under the Disciplined Investor under episode number 524, where they can just click and get the information. But tell me, where can we get your information?
Just 1 second. You had 523 episodes already?
523 episodes, yes. Been doing this since.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I know. These other guys with like, oh, we're on episode 42. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? And on my other podcast, God, we've had 350.
My God. First of all, before I give you I just want to really, you're doing an incredible job.
Thanks.
And every time I come on, it's just so much pleasure, you know, to be with you because you're so much fun and you're such a great host and you're very smart. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
523 episodes.
Yep.
That's incredible.
Yep.
People can find me on the contrarianedge.com.
Okay.
And, you know, the reason I'm, you know, sending them there because my articles are there and it's easy to read them there. Or they can, if they're interested in my firm, they can go to imausa.com.
imausa.com. Vitaly Katsanelson. Thanks, buddy. We'll do it again soon.
My pleasure. Thank
you. Thanks. Now we're going to wrap it up there because it is the weekend of elongated weekend. Markets are closed again for Labor Day. So we'll have a shortened week. We'll have to see how things play out after this whole North Korea hoo-ha and what's going on there. So let's keep an eye on that and make sure to listen in to more business and, well, the lighter side of business, I'll call it, on DH Unplugged each and every Tuesday night with John C. Dvorak, myself, live streaming at 9, or you can pick it up on any iTunes or, you know, anywhere that you can get podcasts. Other than that, if you have any questions, please do me a favor, go over to Ask Andrew. We're going to get to those questions definitely next week. I got a few of them sitting here that I haven't answered directly with email, but I'll answer on the air on the next podcast. So make sure to get your questions in over at Ask Andrew. You can do that over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. A little button there says Ask Andrew. Very simple. Just ask a question and we'll get it on the air. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.